Hey y'all!
Hey.
So if you ever went to the World Service Conference, you know that's how I introduce myself. So anyway, let me get started. First off, I'd like to thank the committee who thought that it would be a real good idea to have a speaker come from all the way from Austin, Texas. I hope that y'all can understand everything I say. I don't really notice that I have an accent, do I?
Yes.
Okay. But I've been around a lot of really great people this weekend, and I've heard y'all's accents too, so just bear with me for a little while. With that, I'll get started. My name's Lori. I'm a speed freak and an alcoholic. By the grace of God, the power of this program, the 12 steps is outlined in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I haven't found it necessary to take a drink or inject methamphetamine since July 21st of the year 2000. For that, I am eternally grateful, because left to my own devices, in and of myself, I shoot dope. That's what I do. I'm ever so grateful to the first step of Cocaine Anonymous that says we are powerless over cocaine and all other mind-altering substances. I tried cocaine. It pissed me off. I tried marijuana. It made me sleepy and made me hungry. But now y'all gonna know how old I am. At the age of 17 years old, I got introduced to some little pills called Black Mollies, White Crosses, and Yellow Jackets. Yes, okay. So before I start beginning my story, I was always taught to do a couple of things out of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. So on page 29 of the Big Book, it says, each individual in his personal stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God. Hopefully tonight I'll let y'all know how my higher power has entered my life and helped me so much. On page 58 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it says, our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. It does not exist. That is a character in the Addams family. I'm going to get to talk about me tonight. I want to share my experience, strength, and hope with each one of you, and hopefully I'll reach one person in this room. You know, I have to tell you this. I was born in San Antonio, Texas, home of the five-time NBA champion San Antonio Spurs. Okay. Anyway, I have a younger sister. She's 18 months younger. My parents, I do not come from a dysfunctional family. The only person that I know in my family that suffered from the disease of maybe alcoholism and drug addiction or gambling addiction was my great-grandfather. I come from a family that's part Catholic. They had some really... I remember that our family reunions were held in Catholic halls that served beer right next to the church. If anybody has come from that. So anyway, I saw drinking at a very young age, but it was just part of life, and I never saw anybody get out of control. I didn't understand what that was. I grew up in North Austin. I was born in San Antonio and moved to Austin. I grew up in a little town outside of Austin called Pflugerville. That's where I went to high school. Pflugerville, yeah. Brian can't say it either, so. Anyway, this was a very small town. They had a really good football team. You were either a basketball player, a cheerleader, a football player, or you participated in the things that they all liked to do, which was drinking. I started drinking at the age of 13 years old. And let me qualify myself. Strawberry Hill, any takers? Mickey's Big Mouth Beer. Okay. And my personal favorite, my very first taste of alcohol outside of drinking my daddy's Falstaff beer when I was little, was the all so good MD 2020. Which my boyfriend stole from the 7-Eleven so we could go get drunk. That's how I started drinking. So I go to high school, I'm a basketball player, I'm a cheerleader. I have to let you know that I did these things only because I was kind of made to do them, because I had to let you see that the outside world was doing real good when the inside world was really crumbling. I was, you know, at 16 years old, a lot of girls go through this funk. I started going through it too. I was extremely boy crazy. I have another addiction. It's called testosterone. I am your classic case codependent, and we'll get to that a little bit in my story later. But, you know, the thing about me is I wanted the outside world to look good. I always had to let you see that everything was going well, even though I was crumbling inside. You know, I graduated high school. I started working for my boyfriend's daddy, which is one of a big thing to do because he owned a construction company. Daddy drove a Cadillac. I was all into that. So I started working there at 17 years old. He broke up with me. And, you know, the whole time during high school, I was drinking and stuff. And like I told you, at 17, I took some pills. And I found out when I took those pills, I wasn't drunk like the other girls. You know, I could hang with the boys, which is where I wanted to be. Now, mind you, I grew up in the era of Farrah Fawcett, and I had that big old Texas hair. You know, jacket to Jesus, you know, the closer, yeah, there you go. Aquanet, the whole nine yards. I was pretty. I was cute, cute, cute. But what I did is, like I said, remember, the outside world has to look good because the inside world is not so hot right now. So, you know, I used men to get to where I wanted to in life. I always had a boyfriend. I did the math when I got into recovery, and from the time I was 13 to the time I was like 34 years old, I was never without a guy. Never without a guy. Maybe a two-week period, and that didn't last long, okay? I've got the addiction of more. It doesn't matter. I want more of whatever it is. So anyway, I start working with this construction company, and my drinking continues. I end up meeting a man when I was 21 years old, and he became my first sponsor, as they say. And now, mind you, I'm just drinking and popping a few pills every now and then, but at that time, I was introduced to IV drugs, and that's the first time I ever shot up, and I found God in a U-100 insulin syringe that day, because from that point on, I never turned back. From the age of 21 to 23, I first was a weekend warrior, if anybody remembers what those are. I only used on the weekends till the weekends started running into Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Yeah, that, okay. Anyway, I married that guy because, you know, he was my first sponsor and he had what I wanted. So anyway, married him, but I was only married to him. Lived with him a year and a half, separated a year and a half. He left me for another woman. And I got a divorce. But as all good drug addicts, I had a backup plan. And I had another man in the wings, and he was a meth cook. Here we go. So anyway, I went to treatment, though, at the age of 23. I got out of treatment. The meth cook wanted to get sober. I'm in the human repair business because I'm going to save you. If I save you, you're going to love me and never leave me. All right? So I got married to him because I was going to save him, and I managed not to drink or use for 10 years. I did not work a program. I did not do any of that. I just didn't use. It was just the ways of my misguided youth. I had went to some AA meetings. They didn't have CA. They had NA. And I just really didn't get it, you know. I just didn't want to get it. It was just the ways of my misguided youth. I married a man. His family had money, by the way. Big thing for me, big old chalk mark there. So I was going to save him. And because I'm a codependent, that's what happened. He didn't stop using, but I did. You know, life goes on. We managed to have, you know, the 2.5 children. We had two cars in the garage. We had a Harley motorcycle. We had a sailboat. He had a $100,000 a year job. Things were going good, you know. And then one day, as the book talks about, there wasn't a cloud on the horizon, he begins to use again. Now, with the two kids in tow, I tell him, you get that stuff out of my house because I'm not going to use around my children. That's not going to happen. Well, that was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. By the time I got home from work at 5 o'clock, I walked through the front door and I said, do you got any dope? Because just like the book says, there's not a cloud on the horizon, and there I go. You know, I couldn't put those words back in my mouth fast enough. He took the kids to his mother's house. He said he was going to get some more stuff, that he dumped it all out, whatever. I said, okay, fine, I'm going to go to the grocery store. Now, y'all, I hadn't drank or used in 10 years, but I wasn't working a program. I walked into that grocery store, and everybody that looked at me knew what I was about to do. The paranoia had already set back in. You know, I was scared that everybody in that store knew what I was doing. I went home, tried to unload the groceries, tried to get rid of the stuff. I didn't try that hard, but I tried a little bit. And And then I remember him going, "Don't worry, honey, I can control it." Every word that a good codependent wants to hear, somebody else is going to control your life, all right? And I do remember sitting there saying to him, "You can't control anything, you know? You can't control what happens now or 5 minutes from now or what happens in your body, but you know what? You told me you could, so I'm going to go ahead and let you." And there starts the cycle again. I was a weekend warrior for one weekend. I began shooting dope again like there was no tomorrow. I denied my children. I compromised everything that I had in life. You know, the classic story as it goes. So what happened was he left me for another woman because I wouldn't stop shooting dope. And I was mad at him. I was mad at him. You know, we had managed to, I had managed to quit my job because I wanted to be a stay-home mom. That's what I told everybody. But the fact is I couldn't go to work anymore because I was knocking off too bad. You know, I could no longer hide what was going on. He did leave me for another woman. I was left with two kids, and I didn't know what I was going to do. But as any good dope fiend knows, when you're a codependent and you have another codependent in your life, they keep coming back. They keep coming back. And so what I did was, is he would be with her on the weekends. He'd come be with me a week when she was working. And, you know, we went through this for a very long period of time. So then one day he told me that he was going to divorce me. And I had a little fit about that. And I just said, "Well, I'll just tell everybody what you're doing." Well, the way the story goes is he brought his girlfriend over to our house. My two kids are there. My parents are there. His parents are there. And he says he is going to move his stuff out. But what he ends up doing is going to the closet where the used syringes are. My child is 9 years old, and he's sitting on the floor in the middle of the bathroom. He proceeds to open that box, throw them up in the air, and those syringes cascade down on top of my son and everything else, and he runs out of the house yelling, "Your mom's a drug addict." And there I was, left to my own devices. What do? I go running after him and say, "Check the DNA in the syringes you were using with me," you know? And by this time, I'm caught. Everybody's there. So my father asked me, he says, "What do you want to do?" I said, "Can I think about it?" At that point in time, my kids were removed from my house. My parents took them. I was left there. I still had dope to do. So for a week, I shot dope. Because that's what I do. That's what kind of drug addict I am, you know. Can I control what I use once I begin to use? Well, I kept running out of dope, so I don't think so, you know. So anyway, my kids were taken away from me. I ran out of dope. I told my dad I wanted to go to treatment because I went to treatment at 23 years old. And I said, "I want to go back to treatment." So took me back to treatment, got out of that treatment facility and managed to stay sober for 72 days. And then I get what I call the old baby phone call. The ex calls and he goes, "Oh, baby, oh, baby, oh, baby." And he wants to come back. And I say, "Okay." Because remember, I'm in the human repair business and I can save people. I've had that much power, you know. So he comes back. I don't shoot dope for about 12 hours. We start shooting dope again. He stays 2 weeks. He left me for the woman he left me for to begin with. And here I'm left with two kids again. This time I go back into the program of Cocaine Anonymous. You know, I say, "Okay, I'm not going to lie to people. I'm not going to do this. I'm going to get a group of friends. I'm going to surround myself with them." I got a sponsor. He was 6 foot tall. That way she could probably sit on me if I tried to run. You know, I kind of worked the program a little bit, but, you know, I managed to stay sober for 37 days. I got the "oh, baby, oh, baby" phone call again, and guess what I did? Out the door running, because, you know, I never really took step three. I was going to give God the fact I couldn't manage my money or the fact I couldn't manage my kids, but I wasn't going to give him the fact that I couldn't manage my man or my dope. You know, that I wasn't going to give up because I felt I had some control. So anyway, he comes back. He stays 2 weeks. He leaves me for the woman he left me for to begin with. This time I got two shots of dope and $900. That's all I got left. My kids are gone. They're with my mom, you know. And I remember the day that I found out that he was leaving and never came back, because he literally went out for a pack of cigarettes and didn't come back. I laid on my bedroom floor and I begged to die. And that was my third step prayer. I asked God to take me out of this world or show me what he'd have me do, because I could not stick another needle in my arm. It was at that moment that my tears dried up. I pulled myself up off that floor. I called the woman that was sponsoring me. I said, what do I do? She said, meet me at a meeting. Since July, that was July 20th, July 21st, this was my sobriety date. Since that day, the obsession to use methamphetamine, drink alcohol, and do my ex-husband has been removed. And trust me, that's a big part of my story, and that's why I tell it. And believe it or not, men, you can be codependent too, because I was married to one. Nothing bad against you, but you can be codependent too. But it was from that point in time that I got back into the rooms of Cocaine Anonymous. I began to be a part of the groups that I attended. I was very lucky to be a part of my home group called Stepsisters. It was a women's meeting that we started, and we started it specifically for women so they could bring their children. You know, I began to work the steps. I did them diligently. I remember I was 11 months sober, and I was able to sponsor somebody. The first time I got a sponsee, I swore to God I was going to kill her. You know, I didn't know that I was going to be able to do this for her. You know, but, you know, what was really cool back then is there was this, we were a very, very small group, and Cocaine Anonymous was very small in Austin at that time. And so we basically clung to each other and just held on to each other, you know, because we were so scared. You know, I would like to tell y'all that life has always been easy peasy since that day, you know, since my higher power removed my obsessions. You know, but it really hasn't. You know, I've been blessed with this journey, and I've been blessed with opportunities. You know, I hear all these cool little sayings, you know, you don't have any challenges, you just have opportunities. Well, it doesn't feel like that some days, okay, damn it. They really feel like they're really bad days, you know. But when I work this program as it's written, I don't do the steps cafeteria style. I do them in order as they're written with a sponsor. I find that my life gets a lot better. You know, I've had the honor and the privilege of being of service to my groups. I've been a secretary, GSR, and treasurer. I've had the honor and privilege of serving my area. I've also been able to be a delegate for the South Central Texas area. That's where I've had the honor to meet a lot of people in this room. I remember my first year at conference committee, I was an alternate delegate, and I walked into the finance committee, and there sits Brian T. And I was like, okay, I'm really scared. I really don't know what I'm doing. But also, too, there was Debbie Denmark, and she was the secretary at that time. And I thought, well, you know, this will be a good committee for me to start out with, you know, because that's what I do. I'm a bookkeeper. So I would start out with that. Unfortunately, I followed Brian to every committee that he went to. and then I was on the conference committee for a while, and that's where I got to meet more people, you know, and that's where I met Kim. And that's where I met, you know, a lot of people from all over the world, which is a really cool thing. You know, I'm really blessed to have been able to be of service. You know, when on the way up here, I was very apprehensive because I'm like, what do these people want to hear from a little old girl from Austin, Texas? You know, I mean, it's just like, God, this was a really big honor. I've never been asked to speak at a convention before, you know, never been asked to do that. You know, and I thought, do I need to tell them about the day of my life when my kids were really little and I would put fake tattoos all over my arms to cover up the track marks when I was going to be in the PTO mom because everything had to look good. I was going into PTO bake sales, you know, how vicious that cycle was, you know. And then I thought of one thing. We all have a common problem. It's the problem of addiction. Doesn't matter what drug we used. I happened to use methamphetamine. Like I said, cocaine pissed me off. It didn't work. It didn't last long enough. But, you know, what did last was methamphetamine. And what did last was trying to hold out to be with a man because I needed to have a significant other to be okay. You know, those addictions had rotted me to my core. You know, I thought those things were going to fill the void that I had, but they didn't. Those things never fill the void. But what I found is that God never lets you down. A human being can and will and do, but God never will let you down. And I have found that today, you know. I mean, each one... each one of us in our personal stories, as I read it before in the beginning, talks about how we found our relationship with God. Whatever your journey is, however far down the scale you have gone, no matter what your bottom is, there's always a way out and there's always a way up. And that's what I keep being reminded. Each year that I stay sober, everybody likes, they say, I do another four step, I do this, I do that. You know, I try to do a reflection and see what goes on each year. You know, unfortunately, with some situations that I have in my life personally, I'm still in the same place that I was about 3 or 4 years ago with the situation. You know, and I had a really good friend tell me, it takes what it takes and you're done when you're done, you know. And one of the things that I really do like to say a lot is the outcome's predetermined. We're just showing up for the results. You know, this room was a lot smaller when I first walked in it tonight. And now this thing is really huge. And I remember turning to my friends and I'm going, this room was, how did this room get so big all of a sudden? You know? I mean, you know, it's an honor and a privilege to stand up here and let each and every one of you know that without your support, without you going to the meeting you go to, without you visiting the H&I that you visit, people wouldn't be in this room this evening, you know? They surely wouldn't. I mean, I've worked the steps with people that are direct descendants from Bill and Bob, and they're really proud to say that all the time. And I'm like, we're all direct descendants from Bill and Bob. We all have worked the steps, you know? And if you haven't, please do work the steps, you know? Please get with somebody and get the freedom that we all, each and every one of us have. You know, I got a high bottom problem today. You know, I don't have low bottom problems anymore. You know, today I did not wake up and try to find the dope, try to find a way to pay for the dope, try to find a way to get the dope, try to find a way to get more dope. That was not what I did today, you know. And that's what I've learned through this program. Everything, there's no problems, there's only solutions, you know. It's if I choose to work it this way, you know. If I choose to do what's laying down in front of me, if I do that nightly review. You know, I have a lot of sponsees. I'm real big on the nightly review. For some reason, my sponsees don't want to do a nightly review. I don't get it, but whatever, you know. You know, the groups that I attend in Austin, you know, our meetings are some different. I had a gentleman that came up here. He went to Akron, Ohio. And he said, I thought it was really cool. They talk about, they go, you give a lead, you don't tell your story. I go, yeah, I got friends up there. I know what that means. Don't act like you're the only one. I know what that means, you know. You know, the cool thing is that we all share one experience. We've all had the disease of addiction, and we still have it today, but we all have a common solution. You know, and that's, you know, all I ever wanted you to do was really like me, and all I ever did was try to get you to do that, whether it had been by shooting dope, drinking beer, hanging out with the boys, doing whatever it was I was doing, being a cheerleader, being a basketball player. Now, don't get me wrong, I like being a basketball player and a cheerleader because I like that attention. But but I only wanted you to like me. You know, I just wanted you to like me because I didn't like myself. You know, I remember sitting in a treatment facility and they'd have people like me come and talk to us. And I'd be going, I got to listen to this bullshit tonight. Really, they're going to tell me how wonderful their life is. Their man left, their dog left, their car don't work. They don't have a place to live, but they're happy. Really? Are you kidding me? You know, and then I would look at my situation and I'm in a treatment facility. And, you know, I was like, okay, you know. And, you know, when I came to the rooms, everybody was talking about how they got their life back, how they got their things back. That really didn't happen for me because I didn't lose my car. I didn't lose my house. My kids were given, my parents had my children. But what I lost was the thing that I couldn't walk to the mailbox without the mysterious he, she's, they's, and those hanging out of those trees watching me go get my mail in the middle of the afternoon, you know. That's what scared me the most, you know. It was all the people that I couldn't see that I thought that were looking at me. That paranoia was gone, which is what really, you know, that's what I wanted to hear when I sat in the meeting. Don't tell me you got your Ferrari back. I could give a shit. You know, tell me how you get out of your house, how you walk out your front door and face the world every day. Because that's what I needed to hear. That's what I wanted to know, you know. And that's how this program started for me. I didn't have the barn burning bush experience. The clouds didn't part. The heavens didn't rain money down on me. Champagne didn't fall. The angels didn't sing. I have the educational variety of the spiritual experience, you know, which through hard work and determination has allowed me today to find a higher power of my understanding, who I choose to call God, and who walks me through things in life, you know. That, you know, that's really basically the simple text of it. You know, I get to do these things today. I don't have to do anything. I get to go to a meeting. I get to fly here. You know, I get to do these things today. You know, they talk about giving back. They talk about, you know, when the hand of CA reaches out to reach back. You know, some days I'm real good on that, and some days when I go to the meeting, by God, I'm the one that needs the meeting. You know, I'm the one that needs to share about what's going on with me. You know, I'm glad somebody else was there. I'm glad that the people that came before me are still here. You know, there's very few people of my home group that are still sober today or still participating in the programs of recovery. You know, I'm very fortunate to be one of the ones. And trust me, I was the relapser of the group, okay? I was the one that was most likely not to succeed. You know, and yet here today I get to stand before you people and share my experience, strength, and hope. You know, service work saved my ass, okay? That's why I talked about what I did in service, because I was a very, you know, it talks about it in the book. You've got to go after your recovery just like you went after your drugs, you know. And for me, I went after drugs and men. But that's another story. Anyway, I was 3 years sober when I worked the steps in codependency. And it wasn't because I had a man. It's because I could not discipline my children. And I was scared to death because I just wanted to be their friend. And I didn't want to have to lay any of that down. But I had to learn to set boundaries. You know, I remember my child, my youngest child is dyslexic, and I had to take him to summer school because that's what they thought he needed to do. And I remember we were having a conversation. He's all of about 9 at this point. And he said, Mom, the very thing I cannot do is read. So the very thing I have to learn how to do and go to school for is read. He goes, just like you, Mom, the very thing you cannot do is do drugs. That's why you go to those meetings, right? I was like, pretty cool, pretty cool. You know, the thing about it is that my kids, I would take them to meetings. And I've shared this before with other people this weekend. It's like when they were smaller, I took them to meetings. And I remember the youngest one again said something really cute. And he's like, we were coming home from a meeting. And he goes, Mom, is our house in order? I said, well, my side of the house is clean, but you need to clean up your room. You know, my kids used to quote the Big Book a lot, and they used to tell, and you know, there were certain points that they used it against me, and I'll get to that in a minute, but, you know, but I would not let them get away with that after I got a little bit older in sobriety. You know, it's real funny today. Sometimes they go with me to my anniversary meetings to get my chip, and then sometimes they'll go, oh, my youngest is 20, he still lives with me, and he'll go, Mom, maybe I'll go to the meeting with you tonight. I'm like, yeah, no, because you're going to be the subject of conversation when I get to that meeting, so you ain't going with me. You know, and he's like, really? You know, and I said, yeah, really. I need to talk about you. You know, and he just kind of sloughs it off and walks away. He thinks it's a joke, but it's really not. You know, the hardest place I ever found to work this program is in my own home, raising 2 boys by myself. That was the hardest thing I ever had to learn how to do. And this word that I think a lot of addicts and alcoholics will understand, this word called boundaries, it was the hardest thing I ever had to learn to do as well. And sometimes I do good at it, and sometimes I don't do real good. But, you know, it's progress, not perfection. And I don't use that as a cop-out. I use it as a learning thing. Because please understand, my children were 9 and 5 when I got sober. So when my youngest one tries to throw to me, because he has had some tantrums, about how his life is so messed up because I did drugs, I quickly remind him he was 5 years old and he didn't suffer that much. He did suffer some things, but you're not going to throw that in my face. You don't get the opportunity to use that against me, not anymore, because I've made an amends to you. So, you know, what I found in this program is that, and I heard it said earlier in the workshop that the Denmarks did, it was, you know, reason or season. People stay in your life, you know. And I found that to be true in mine. There's been people that have come into my life, and some of them have stayed for a long period of time, the 14 years that I've been sober, and some of them have not. You know, and sometimes I don't understand why, but they're a gift. You know, however long somebody comes into your life and stays for is a gift. Appreciate that is what I learned. You know, it's just Cocaine Anonymous has given me the opportunity to do things on my own with no help from the outside world. It's allowed me to make decisions. It's allowed me to show me, it showed me the way to do certain things that I did not know how to do by myself. When you're raising 2 boys, you know, things come up like, how am I gonna teach them how to shave? And how am I gonna teach them how to do this? And how am I gonna teach them how to do that? you know, what was really cool is the first time my son had to shave. He goes, "Mom, you want to come watch me?" I go, "Okay, I guess you shave with the grain, not against it. I don't know." And then after that, every time he would shave, he goes, "You want to come watch?" I go, "Yeah, not really. It's not that interesting anymore." You know? You know, the things that I was so afraid of, you know, God took care of, you know? The only thing I had to fear was fear itself, as they say. You know, when I went through treatment and I started working the steps and I got out and, you know, I was sitting in a process group and one of the things that they taught us, you know, was about, you know, when you go through the steps of, you know, the principles and all of that. But one of the things is we broke down the steps and I had to break them down personally for me, so I'd like to share that with y'all tonight. So it says, step one, we admitted we were powerless over cocaine and all other mind-altering substances. Our lives have become unmanageable. And, you know, that was about admitting that I used every day that ended in Y, and I couldn't stop, you know. And that was about honesty. You know, step two said, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. Lori, there's a God, and you're not it. Get off the cross, because we need the wood. Step three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. I didn't understand that one, because I told you that's the one I wouldn't give up. And it was about turning my actions and my thoughts over to God and agreeing to work the rest of the steps. Now, step four, you know, you got to make that searching and fearless moral inventory. Well, the first time I did step four, I did it wrong, if you can imagine, because when I took it to my sponsor, she goes, "These are all resentments you have about people that have harmed your ex-husband. What is your problem?" I said, "I think I might be codependent." She goes, "You think?" She goes, "We'll get to that later. Let's rework that step." So I did. When I admitted to God and ourselves and another human being the exact nature of my wrongs, I was so afraid to tell my sponsor what I had done and all my little nasties. And she said, "God's already seen all your little nasties. Just go ahead and get them out and get them done." Step six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. You know, I really thought God was going to come down and pluck them out. And I was no longer going to be a liar or a cheater or all this stuff. No, that's really not how it worked. But I was able to write down my character defects and take a look at them. I remember one of my character defects was I was a selfish, and I was a codependent, and I was a gossip. And I thought, no, that's what all y'all did to me. You know, I wasn't that way. But I found out very quickly that I was. Humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. You know, when I spent that hour with God, he really helped me see that he wasn't going to pluck those things out, but he was going to give me an opportunity to work on them. And that's exactly what he did, and I'm grateful for that. Made that, and step eight, made a list of all persons we'd harmed, became willing to make amends to them all. I made that list and shared it with my sponsor, and I went to go make an amends to my ex-mother-in-law. And bless her heart, she said she couldn't accept my amends until she called her son, which was my ex-husband, and asked her if it was okay. And I just said, my side of the street is clean. By what they tell me, I'm good. made a direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so or injure them or others. When I went to make my amends to my children, I did, you know, as my sponsor instructed, my children were small. And I said, I need to make an amends to you, and part of it's going to be a living amends, and this, this, and this. And my older son, and I said, at the end, I said, what can I do to right these wrongs? I do have some suggestions, but I need to hear from you, as I was told. And my older son goes, can you buy me a computer? I go, that's not how this works, but Mom will make sure that you get a computer before, you know, you really, really need it, but you can use the one at Nana's house. My younger son at that time, he got very, very upset, and he said, Mom, I don't understand what you're asking me. I just don't want you to do the things you did when Dad was here. And I just said, okay, you know. And he was crying about it because he didn't understand. But today he does, and so that's a really cool thing. Step 10, continue to take personal inventory. We're wrong, probably admitted it. Yeah, I like to do that one, and sometimes my cop-out is I won't do it tomorrow. But I've had to learn to work that step diligently and make amends when I need to make amends. And when I can't make amends, I need to call somebody and tell them why. And it's usually based on nothing but fear. And fear is that corroding thread that will rob you of all of your serenity, or it does me anyway. Step 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. You know, what I do with that is that I have to give myself over to God. There's two-way prayer that I was taught. I can talk a whole lot to God and it sounds like begging, but that's okay, because sometimes I'm really afraid and I just need to beg for a little bit. But what I do know is that God always answers. He may not give me the answer I want. It's usually yes, no, or wait. But I know he always shows up, and he never has let me down. Step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to addicts and to practice these principles in all our affairs. I've been fortunate enough to do H&Is. I've been fortunate enough to share one-on-one with men or women. And just like I am sitting here today, I was fortunate enough to share with a room full of people that took time out of their busy schedule to attend this wonderful convention in Wisconsin and to sit here and participate in all the activities. And he wanted to come to the speaker tonight. You know, I appreciate each and every one of you. I appreciate your recovery. I appreciate what you're doing for your fellow man or woman. You know, but the biggest thing is that, you know, how do you judge? What is the saying? It's just like, how do you judge your success with your sobriety or your sponsees or whatever? Did you stay sober today? You know, because some days all I have is I just didn't drink or use today. It doesn't matter if you've got 30 minutes or 30 years. You know, each and every one of us suffer with that spiritual malady that we need to solve, whatever, with whatever higher power that we choose. You know, and that's what I find today. You know, I mean, thank you for sitting in this room tonight and taking time out to listen to me. I appreciate it. Thank you so much for asking me to be here. You know, the truth is I don't really care which AA you go to. Find a group, find a home group that will love you and take care of you. And you can open yourself and be vulnerable to them and let them open themselves up to you. Because the program of Cocaine Anonymous gave this little speed freak the opportunity to stay sober one more day. Thanks for letting me share.